These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. They are produced by The Teaching Company. The Great Courses cover a broad array of university-level disciplines. The lectures in each course are either 30 or 45 minutes long. By listening for less than an hour a day, you can finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalog or website and imagine how much you could learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the best college classrooms in the world. The lecturers are university professors, carefully selected by the teaching company and its customers for intellectual distinction and teaching excellence. These lectures are titled The Discovery of Ancient Civilizations, Part 1. The lecturer is Professor Brian Fagan. Professor Fagan is a professor of anthropology at the University of California at Santa Barbara, where he has been teaching for over 35 years. Born in England and educated at Pembroke College, Cambridge, Dr. Fagan earned his BA, MA, and PhD in archaeology and anthropology. Professor Fagan has served as the director of the Bantu Studies Project of the British Institute for Eastern Africa, visiting associate professor at the University of Illinois Urbana, and visiting professor at Whittier College and the University of Cape Town, South Africa. Professor Fagan was a Guggenheim Fellow and has received numerous awards, including the Public Service Award of the Society of Professional Archaeologists and the Public Education Award of the Society for American Archaeology. He is also the recipient of a Distinguished Teaching Award from the University of California at Santa Barbara. A prolific author, Dr. Fagan's numerous books include People of the Earth and In the Beginning, two widely used university and college textbooks in archaeology and prehistory. His other works include The Rape of the Nile, The Adventure of Archaeology, and The Little Ice Age. He also edited The Oxford Companion to Archaeology. Professor Fagan prepared the course guide that comes with these tapes. The course guide includes a detailed outline of each lecture, a timeline, maps, a glossary, biographical notes, and a bibliography. To get the most out of this course, you may find it useful to follow along with the outlines or review them before or after each lecture. Lecture 1, The Quest for Civilization.
Hello, I'm Brian Fagan, an archaeologist at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And in this course, we're going to take a journey through the world of early archaeology and tell the story of the discovery of the ancient civilizations, one of the most romantic and exciting scientific journeys of the 19th and 20th centuries. It's a story full of compelling characters, high adventure, heroes, and villains, as well as a great deal of serious science as well. This course has an overall plan which is based on going from one area to another. It's a little confusing, perhaps. So in this lecture, I'm going to give you a general overview of the plan of the course, the navigation which we're going to undertake through this complex and fascinating subject. This first lecture covers three major topics. First, I'm going to outline and explain the approach that the lectures take to the discovery of ancient civilizations. I'm going to summarize the overall story and the major scientific developments, which were turning points in this process of discovery. Then I'm going to define what we mean by a civilization, a pre-industrial civilization, and look at some of the characteristics which these early civilizations share. Because some idea of the sort of parameters of what we're talking about is important to establish right at the beginning. And then finally, at the end of this lecture, I'm going to start the narrative by describing Greek and Roman perceptions of the first civilizations and the origins of civilization, which is a very logical baseline to use for our later explorations. The discovery of the ancient civilizations was one of two basic threads in the early history of archaeology's scientific development. The evolution of archaeology as a serious science, which it is today in the early 21st century, is one of the great scientific triumphs of the last 150 years. As we will say again and again, archaeology has a respectable ancestry among treasure hunters and adventurers. And it was these treasure hunters and adventurers and army generals and others who founded, ultimately, the discipline we know today. But they wouldn't recognize it because it is now complex, draws on the skills of many academic disciplines, and is immensely complex. But the early history of archaeology is really a gigantic adventure story. There are two major threads, as I said. The first one is concerned with the antiquity of humankind, an early human evolution. It dealt, and still deals, with a very basic question. How old are human beings? When did they first appear on Earth? In the early 19th century, most people believed that the story of human creation in the first chapter of Genesis in the Old Testament was the literal historical truth. Archbishop Usher in the 17th century calculated that the world was founded in the year 4004 BC, allowing only 6,000 years for the entire spectrum of human existence, civilizations, the Romans, the Greeks, medieval times, and everything before it. And one thread of the story of the discovery of the past deals with the demonstration that human antiquity was infinitely longer. Today we know it's 2.5 million years, and that the first humans appeared in East Africa. But this was an unimaginable story in the 19th century. The second thread, which is the one we're concerned with in this course, is that of the early civilizations. It's concerned with a very fundamental question which has fascinated people ever since Greek and Roman times, and perhaps before. Where did civilization originate? Civilization as we know it. When did medicine begin? Writing, cities, all the apparatus of a modern-day civilization. This question has driven much of the inquiry and search for lost civilizations. We're all familiar with the notion of lost civilizations, mysteries, golden pharaohs, and lost societies like Atlantis, covered in swirling, ever-parting, and then thickening mist. There is a strong aura of romance over the discovery of the early civilizations. Our purpose in this course is to tell you what we really found. What lost civilizations were discovered, and by whom and why? And we're not concerned here with Atlantis and all the pseudo-archaeological apparatus which people festoon this subject with. We are concerned here with archaeology and archaeologists, with people who dug and surveyed to find the past. What approach are we going to take to this story? Obviously, this is a narrative course. It's a story divided into numerous manageable parts, but ultimately it's a narrative, and a chronological narrative which begins in classical times and ends in the mid-20th century. Why do we choose the mid-20th century to end? Very simply, because at that point science's impact on archaeology was so intense that the research became highly specialized, much more detailed, and intensively involves the use of all kinds of scientific technology, from computers to isotopes. This is the story of civilization as we know it today, based on science. What I'm concerned with is all the events and discoveries that happened up to the moment, in the 1960s really, where archaeology became a really, truly modern science. This course is divided into two parts of 12 lectures each. It's a natural division. It works well. Part one, Adventurers and Archaeologists, the first 12 lectures, describes the initial discovery of ancient civilizations, from Roman times to the beginnings of scientific excavation in the late 19th century. Part two, Science and Civilization, once again 12 lectures, covers scientific advances and discoveries from the late 19th and early 20th to mid-20th centuries, a prelude, as I said, to the intricate science of today. So we have two halves, and the theme between the two, the link between the two, is at the end of part one with people like Heinrich Schliemann, the discoverer of Troy and Mycenae. You begin to see the first appearance with German archaeologists working at the same time as him on classical sites. The first concern with detail and recording. So really this is a story of accumulating science. The story begins with the Greeks and the Romans, who believed that ancient Egypt was the fountain of all civilization. This belief persisted through the Middle Ages and into the 19th century. But this was speculation. Serious research into the ancient civilizations began with General Napoleon Bonaparte's invasion of Egypt in 1798. A momentous expedition, which, as we will see, resulted in the discovery of the Rosetta Stone and ultimately the decipherment of Egyptian hieroglyphs. Even more important, it led to a much greater consciousness of the exotic nature and the lessons which ancient civilization could reveal about the world, because ancient Egyptian civilization was exotic and completely different from that of Greece and Rome. Fast forward a little bit. We then go to the 1840s, when there were large-scale excavations, again, ultimately begun by government sponsoring of excavations. The French government sent a consul to Mosul, Emile Paul Botta, to Mosul in northern Iraq. He dug, he found the Assyrian civilization, and was followed by a compelling character, Austin Henry Layard, an Englishman, who dug and ultimately established the identity of biblical Nineveh, hitherto thought to be just a collection of dusty mounds. And it was Henry Creswick Ward Rawlinson who deciphered hieroglyphs with the aid of other scholars and was able to write the first short history of a civilization, that of the Assyrians, known only as shadowy people in the Old Testament. There is this theme through the 19th century, a determination in a devout age to prove the historical veracity of the scriptures. Meanwhile, also in the same part of the course, we look at Maya country, at the travelers John Lloyd Stevens and the artist Frederick Catherwood, who described ancient Maya ruins in Central America and revealed them in two best-selling books to an astonished world. They were part, in the 1840s, of the heroic age of archaeological discovery, an age when literally you could go out and find an ancient civilization in a month and make spectacular discoveries, mount major exhibitions, and become an international figure. The early archaeologists were adventurers and travelers. Relatively few of them were scholars, although many of them actually made very significant contributions. This heroic age ends with the German businessman turned archaeologist Heinrich Schliemann, whose obsession with the historical truth of Homer's Iliad and Odyssey led him to excavate and discover, or so he claimed, Troy in 1871, and to unearth the Mycenaean civilization of Greece in 1876. But And here the theme of the course gradually changes. Schliemann was the last of his breed, or almost so. He was out for his own justification. He was a self-publicist. He was a digger on a brutal, large, rough scale. Austin Henry Layard tunneled into Nineveh. Schliemann employed engineers from the Suez Canal to tunnel and trench into Troy. But this sort of excavation was becoming an anachronism. And as we shall see, in the 1870s, the Prussian and Austrian governments sponsored excavations at clatical sites, among them Olympia, the site of the Olympic Games, in the 1870s. They did unheard-of things. They had a permanent architect on site, draftsmen who draw plans. They founded a museum at Olympia where the finds were put and only duplicates went back to Germany. Instead of removing the past and taking it to foreign museums and foreign lands, they left patrimony in the country from which it came. This was a watershed in the discovery of the ancient civilizations. It wasn't a dramatic watershed, but it was a sign that things were changing. And one of the characters whom we'll look at and devote indeed an entire lecture to was an Egyptologist, another Englishman, Flinders Petrie, self-taught, one of the last self-taught archaeologists, who in the 1880s carried out a remarkable accurate survey of the pyramids of Giza in Egypt, scandalizing tourists by walking around in his red underwear, which in the respectable Victorian age you did not do. But at the same time, he was beginning to pay careful attention to occupation layers and to small artifacts, not the big spectacular finds, but the minute details of pottery, decoration, and so on. He influenced an entire generation of students and other archaeologists, among them an Englishman, Arthur Evans, who was also influenced by Schliemann. Evans had minute eyesight, and thanks to tracing teeny engraved seals, which he bought in the Athens flea market, he was able to identify the capital of an ancient civilization on Crete at Knossos, which he excavated in 1900 and dug for more than 30 years, using Petrie's dating methods. So you begin to see that innovative methods used by different archaeologists begin to have an impact on the discovery. And we'll trace this increasing impact, going from Evans to another archaeologist, George Wisner, an American Egyptologist, who discovered the Kerma state in the Sudan, whose methods were even more thorough than those of Flinders Petrie. Petrie published, Wisner did not, so a lot of his work is still unpublished. And perhaps the most flamboyant of all British archaeologists in the 20th century, we also tell the story of British excavator Leonard Woolley, who learnt his archaeology in the Sudan, some of it with Wisner, learnt how to handle local people, and then before World War I, in a fascinating vignette of early archaeology, which we will describe, he excavated the Hittite city of Carchemish in Syria. This he did with the assistance of T. Lawrence, later to become Lawrence of Arabia. And from there, we see the increasing sophistication of archaeology in the 20th century. We follow it through great discoveries. We visit the Andes, at the side of Hiram Bingham, as he discovers, or visits rather, to be more accurate, the great Inca city of Machu Picchu. We are at the side of Lord Carnarvon and Howard Carter as they open the spectacular tomb of Tutankhamun in 1922. Carter was trained by Petrie, so you have this string of people gradually improving the skill of archaeology. And then on the other side of the world, at about the same time, you have the discovery of the Shang civilization in northern China's Huanghe River Valley. You have Woolley building on his earlier experience and undertaking the incredibly ambitious project of excavating Sumerian Ur of the Chaldees. He found the royal burials, which in their lavishness rival the sepulchre of Tutankhamun. We visit another excavation, found originally in the 19th century, when bricks from the cities were used to build railroad beds, the Harappan civilization in the Indus Valley of what is now Pakistan, discovered between the 1920s and the 1940s. All these finds in China, in Iraq, in India, proved that the pre-industrial civilizations flourished over a far wider area of the Old World than just the Eastern Mediterranean. We look at the discovery of virtually all the early civilizations. And then we end the course with a summary of the stages of archaeological discoveries over two centuries, using three important finds to illustrate the increasing impact of science. And we conclude with a summary, once again, of the similarities between the world's pre-industrial civilizations. What is distinctive about them? Why are they important? What distinguishes them from modern-day civilizations? So we give you a journey, and a journey with some analysis. A journey, as I said, full of compelling characters, fascinating adventures, and some truly spectacular finds. But before embarking on our narrative, we must pause a moment and examine what we mean by ancient civilization. It's a rag-bad word, if ever there was one. More argument has gone on about the definition of early states, about a definition of civilization, than almost any other subject in archaeology. Much of this debate is very arid and irrelevant, and we will never reach agreement. So for the purposes of this course, I've made some rather arbitrary definitions so that we can move on. For the purposes of these 24 lectures, the word ancient refers to the first pre-industrial civilizations. And I stress, pre-industrial. And a pre-industrial civilization is one that relied on the labor of human hands and did not use fossil fuels like coal. These civilizations functioned on the ability of rulers to control labor and use it and deploy it to build pyramids, palaces, roads, whatever they wanted. But having given that very arbitrary definition, how do we define a pre-industrial civilization? Here are some pointers. These are grossly general points, but enough to get us going. Most archaeologists agree that the appearance of the first pre-industrial civilizations coincides with the first appearance of cities. We use the word city. What do we think of? Immediately, London, Washington, D.C., New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, cities with millions of inhabitants. It's very important to realize a number of things about the ancient world, and one of them is not only that communication was much slower, which is a point we shall come back to again and again, but also there were many fewer people. Remember, when the first civilizations appeared, most people were living in villages of a few hundred souls. So, quite arbitrarily, many years ago, an archaeologist defined a city as a community with more than 5,000 people in it. Now, contemplate that in a landscape where everybody lives in small villages. That is a big community. So we take this definition, and places like Sumerian Ur probably didn't have that many more inhabitants. Many of these early cities were literally agglomerations of villages that came together for defense or for economic reasons, for irrigation, for example, and maybe even had their own neighborhoods linked with kin. You get much larger pre-industrial cities later, like the Aztec capital, Tenochtitlan, which is estimated to have had about 200,000 people living around it and so on. But the earliest cities were small, so an arbitrary definition of more than 5,000 seems logical. Another characteristic. The use of writing, or some form of record keeping. As we will say again and again, writing in these societies and literacy was power. Why? Because you had access to information. It didn't necessarily have to be writing. In the case of the Inca of Peru, they used knotted strings, which were a form of code which allowed scribes to inventory resources and people in different districts conquered by the Inca. Another characteristic, what's called social stratification. Some type of kingship and strongly centralized government. As a general, gross generalization, all early civilizations, pre-industrial civilizations, were pyramids. They, at the top, had a ruler, maybe often a divine ruler, a small group of senior nobles, many of them related to the royal family, an elite, and under it, classes, priests, and artisans, and officials, and below that, the great mass of commoners and sometimes slaves, the labor of whom supported the peak of the pyramid. If you want a gross generalization, pre-industrial civilizations had millions of people working for the benefit of a few. Social stratification. There are many other characteristics, but there are three important ones which are worth keeping in mind. Our concern here is with the civilizations that preceded the classical civilizations in the Old World, and with the pre-industrial states that arose elsewhere than the Mediterranean and in the Americas. I do want to stress that this is not just a course about the Mediterranean world, although obviously there are many references to it. We are looking here at early civilizations and the discovery of them on a truly global perspective. Why? Because this is the only way you can look at early human history. Because early human history is a global thing, not just a local thing. Choosing sites for these lectures was very difficult, obviously, given the global perspective. So what I've done is deliberately selected sites and civilizations which are the better known or are the more often visited, because I know that many people listening to this course will in fact or have visited sites like the Parthenon, the Pyramids, or Knossos. Or alternatively, that they have a civilization or a site that make an important contribution to the narrative as a whole. There are some sites, like Carchemish, for example, that aren't very well known, but the mere vignette of Woolley working there make them an integral and fascinating part of the story. In some cases, too, I've included an individual site and given it a lot of attention. Ur is one. Another one is Tutankhamun's sepulchre, a discovery which is probably the most spectacular ever made, which caused a worldwide furor of the time and still causes fever whenever an exhibit of its finds is mounted outside Egypt. It is worth and has an entire program. We begin our story with the Greeks and Romans, who were well aware of the existence of much earlier civilizations. The Greeks acknowledged that the arts of civilization, and above all of medicine, the institutions of civilization, came from Egypt, which was then under Hellenic rule. Indeed, it was a Greek priest, Manetho, who collected the king lists of ancient Egypt and compiled the first list of the dynasties of the ancient Egyptian pharaohs, a dynasty list which is still used by Egyptologists to this day. The Ptolemies were very proud of their rule of Egypt. They adopted, some say cynically, many of the religious beliefs and institutions and ceremonies and roles of the ancient pharaohs. In a real sense, they perpetuated the institutions of ancient Egypt. The Romans inherited the belief of the Greeks that ancient civilization originated along the Nile. And they reinforced this with an easy familiarity of Egypt. What is not generally known is that there was a flourishing tourist trade between Italy and Egypt during the height of the Roman Empire. regular galleys ran from southern Italy to Alexandria like clockwork. The tourist would take this, have a thorough debauch in the flesh plots of Alexandria, then take a boat up to the pyramids and go on to Luxor and Karnak and the Valley of Kings, just as their successors do today. And they would pause in particular at two huge seated pharaonic statues on the west banks of the Nile, known today as the Colossi of Memnon, and many of them would inscribe their names on the base of these colossal seated figures. Why? Because these seated figures were as famous in their day as Westminster Abbey or the Capitol in Washington, D.C. They were a major tourist destination because at sunrise, as the sun warmed the stones would emit noises. So the tourists went to hear the noises and wrote their graffiti on the foot of these statues. Until the Emperor Septimus Severus, who apparently had no sense of humor, repaired the cracks and the noise stopped. And believe it or not, there are people who actually studied these tourists' graffiti. The tourists of Rome have become an academic subject of inquiry. So the Romans were well aware of Egypt. But the origins of civilization were wrapped in mystery from classical times until long after the Renaissance, partly due to the spread of Islam, and partly due to the fact, as we will see, that Egypt became a province of the Ottoman Empire, an Islamic empire, based on Constantinople. It was off limits to Europeans. So the origins of civilization kind of receded into the background, particularly as young gentlemen and ladies took tours, the grand tour of classical lands, and never looked much further than the narrow confines of the northern Mediterranean. Even going to Greece was an adventure. And then, in 1798, everything changed, because in that year, a French general with a passion for science, General Napoleon Bonaparte, mounted an expedition to Egypt and invaded it. His armies remained there till 1804, and with him he took a team of scientists who, with their remarkable discoveries, which included the Rosetta Stone, were to set in motion the frenzied search for the origins of civilization, remarkable for the 19th century.